Session 17 of the Waking Down Recitation and Commentary Course. Commentary on, this is now part 3 of our consideration of chapter 8 in the book, The Rot, Out of Head, Mind, Soul Awareness, and Into Heart, Body, Consciousness. So you'll recall that some sessions back, I think, where I was offering comments about the first birth and its difference from the second birth and the second life, I read an essay from Surefire that was titled, or is titled, Why It's Harder for a First Life Realizer to Rot into the Core Wound Than It Is for a Camel to Lodge Itself in the Eye of a Needle, or if we interpret the Aramaic of that original biblical phrase, that axiom from Jesus, it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to enter the eye of a needle. The better interpretation of that original word is rope rather than camel, which makes a lot more sense. But why I'm inclined to remind us of that is because as I read this chapter, I'm emphasizing people's difficulty falling into the rot because they're in the anxious mode of superimposed and formulaic seeking. And even lately, I've been reminded again that they may not be very anxious at all. In fact, a first birth realizer may be a profoundly happy, serene, peaceful, joyous individual with a rich, mystical, visionary life and ready access to all the bliss he or she could possibly want to be flooding through his or her body and brain and heart and soul. So, you know, you may not have anxious hope. You may, it says here, as long as you have a path, as long as you have anxious hope, you may be beyond anxious hope. But you, as long as you have a path, a trajectory that you're traveling, an arc of growth, or even an arc of abidance and easy access to grace and bliss and blessedness, you're not prepared yet to encounter and embrace existence as the core wound. Therefore, you will not permit yourself to endure the onset and the consequences of the rot. And that goes again to part of the other portion I read there, that if you imagine that you've already gone through the rot in your earlier kinds of deep psychological and spiritual work, this is not going to touch you, and there's nothing intrinsically bad with that, but it does seem to me that there's a whole other dimension of your, both your humanness and your divinity and their inextricable essential sameness that you may be missing. You just may be missing. So, from Surefire, I'll read a bit here. This is page 94. You can't choose the rot, it chooses you. More on the paradoxical qualifications of true candidates for this sacred passage. The rot then picks you up out of the relatively black and white world of conventional values and meanings, plunges you into massive disintegrations, and like an invisible stork, drops you newborn on your own doorstep, needing to grow into a whole new life of living color. Sounds good, right? Most people who've gotten this far in considering my work, in their reading both of this volume and its prerequisites, such as Waking Down and the White Hot Yoga of the Heart, not necessarily prerequisites both, although obviously Waking Down, I would hope you'll be reading the book as well as listening to the recitations and commentary. But most people who've gotten this far in considering my work, in their reading both of this volume and of possibly Waking Down the White Hot Yoga of the Heart, will probably have by now a positive orientation to the rot. If they haven't already gone through it, they will really want to. I still think that might be true. I don't know if you've been doing this much listening. This has led to some poignant dialogues with people from me and my adept colleagues. Quite understandably, folks want to know, am I rotting yet? Is this what the rot feels like? How will I know that the rot is happening? I don't feel like any heavy thing is going on inside me or in my outward life. Are you sure this is the rot? Or it just seems like my life is being turned upside down everywhere I look, but I don't feel like it's really changing me. Can this be what you mean by the rot? Or I haven't had a lot of spiritual success, but I'm still involved in various ways of trying to open or change myself. Does that mean I'm not really rotting or really ready for the rot? When a sacred transformation becomes attractive to you, it is totally natural to want to make sure you're qualified for it. If you are, you can breathe a sigh of relief. If you're not, hopefully you can do whatever it takes to get on track, to get ready, to meet the specifications. This is as true of mutual waking down as it is of any other path or approach. So people who are attracted to this path want to make sure they're good candidates. And well, they should. More power to them, I say. Unfortunately, however, I have to tell you that I've never been able to identify too many marks of a good candidate for the rot, at least in terms of previous experience, general life history, and so on. Because it is a most sacred turning point whose fundamental impact is the very essence of your being, there are no definitive signals for it or for your readiness to enter it in your outer life. You may be young or old, male or female, from any national or ethnic background. You may be successful or not in your career, happy or not in your relationships, healthy or ill, learned or untutored, full of basic self-esteem or terribly lacking it. One way or another, the fundamental dis-ease, distress, incompleteness, separateness, alienation, or isolation at the core of your existence, emptiness, other words. I'm trying to come up with other words, I can't, but there could be others. At the core of your existence begins to infect your whole life, even if things stay relatively happy, calm, bright, and cheery on the surface. You lose the capacity to put it all together anymore. You lose the charm. You lose the juice. And whether you're able to keep up appearances and continue participating in the ordinary routines of life or not, the world turns gray and pale for you in a most pervasive way. That's the paradox of readiness for the rot, or of what life is like when you're in it. Even that description, of course, will likely prompt more questions in you until you've gone all the way through it. Good. Speak then. Just because you've read my list of some of the typical anxious concerns people have about the rot and where they are in it, don't hesitate to bring up such questions when they press in on you. Bring them to the attention of your adept or other awakened friends. Let us meet and see you where these questions are alive and pulsing in you. That kind of meeting will clarify your understanding and quicken your passage, even if it doesn't allay your fears or concerns in the moment. You can't choose the rot. It chooses you. Yet it also is you. You are not other than the rot when you are rotting. No god or goddess, no mystic guru or shaman, no spirit guide, no other of any kind, large or small, may deign to visit the rot upon you. No such other can visit the rot upon you. Not even any divine controller of destinies can decide it is time for you to rot and make it happen to you. No other human or divine can make this occur because the rot cannot and does not happen to you. It is your own self-disclosing gateway into the fullest possible autonomy of being yourself. When the time comes, you simply ripen into it like a fruit on a branch, or more precisely, like a fruit after it has fallen off the branch onto the ground. So, mixing metaphors, I can say that you ripen into rotting when your time is ripe. In the Bible, divine spirit is likened to a wind that, quote, blows where it wills. The rot is like a dead calm at the center of everything. It doesn't blow anywhere. It's a Sargasso sea of being. Drift into it and you drift out only by luck, chance, and grace. Maybe you never really do drift out of that strange and listless place, but something else overtakes you even there. So clearly we're talking about the core. So let's see what else I want to read here. I already read some of that. Now we're going to get into some esoteric matters here that will then prepare us really to move on into the next chapter. So this will go on for a little while. How falling into the heart begins with the rot, and why humanity has not had the opportunity to go through the rot until now. The evolution of more ready access to our identity's fundamental center of gravity in the heart. So happy I was moved to write all this long ago. So glad to be able to pass it on to you now. Okay, here beginneth this essay. The soul's base of identity is seated in the general region of the head. Even if we are not aware of what I've called in this book our quote-unquote soul-ish nature, that is, even if we don't have a predominantly spiritual as opposed to material experience of being an individual person, it's obvious to me that the human sense of identity is located in the head until we, quote-unquote, fall or, quote-unquote, dive into the heart. Though I had studied primary teachings on this transition for more than two decades, I did not clearly understand it until I fell into the heart myself. I had had many premonitions of the fall, but they were still being experienced from the platform of my individual soul nature in the region of the brain. I have told people that in those earlier glimpses, it was as if I were doing back dives off a high platform. I'd fall temporarily into an intuition of the conscious ground of being, but then without any effort, indeed not wanting it to occur, I'd be right back up on the platform. That is, I'd find myself back in the soul-based mind of my separate individuality as I, or me. In that disposition, I'd be unable to sustain the deeper awareness of the non-individuated, formless quality of consciousness. It was only when I fell into the heart conclusively, in mid-October 1992, that this deeper intuition became self-regenerating. In effect, I never shot back up to the platform of the head-based mind-soul awareness again. The basic center of gravity of my very identity had shifted once and for all. I wasn't able to grasp the difference until I had realized it so conclusively. All the reading, all the listening to teachings, all the communion with great heart realizers, and all the temporary intuitions I could possibly have could not disclose the true meaning of falling or diving into the heart, capital H, until the fall itself. Then that meaning became quite obvious. The phrases, quotation, diving into the heart, end quote, falling into the heart, were coined by the great pioneers of the passage into conscious embodiment, Ramana Maharshi and Adida, respectively. Though I have not done exhaustive scholarship, I am not aware of any significant precursors to their findings and revelations. It's my belief that through their realizations and revelations, Ramana and Adida have opened up a new understanding of the nature of spiritual liberation and transformation, and a new path of access to it. I also feel that my own work turns that new path from a bumpy trail through the jungle that only a few can negotiate into a broad paved avenue that many, many, many can travel with ease. ease is maybe, we might want to put that in quotation marks. In other words, people can negotiate the passage relatively directly. That makes it, in a sense, easeful, direct, and accomplishable. It's not easy to go through, and that's not, therefore, what I meant. There's a lovely story about Ramana Maharshi that I see as a snapshot of the essence of his whole impulse in life. It's from the pictorial biography of Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi. The story goes that Ramana was sitting, as was his custom, in the meditation hall where, for many hours each day, he granted darshan, or sacred viewing, to devotees and pilgrims for many hours. Among those attending was an illustrious disciple named Ganapati Muni, himself a spiritual teacher and a renowned scholar-poet of yogic wisdom. That day, a group of simple village folk appeared in the hall. They had made a pilgrimage from some distance. This was their first opportunity to have the darshan of the great sage. Addressing him as Bhagavan, meaning Lord, they requested him to instruct them in spiritual practice. The Maharshi gracefully responded by giving them detailed instructions in the ultimate wisdom and method of self-enquiry he taught for realizing the divine consciousness. The villagers listened attentively. After spending a while in his presence, they respectfully rose and left the hall to make their journey home. I got the distinct impression that these folks traveled a long way to get there. Maybe most likely by on foot, or, you know, in other words, this wasn't, oh, we finally decided to come see Bhagavan, we'll be back. This was once in a lifetime. At least that's the impression I have. It enhances the story, even if it's not true. Oh, far too honest. But it is the genuine impression that I had. Soon thereafter, in any case, Ramana himself rose to take his daily walk. When he had left the hall, some of the regularly attending devotees asked Ganapati Muni what he thought of the Maharshi's interchange with the villagers. The Muni, and Muni means sage, replied that he felt the Maharshi had made a mistake. Here were these simple-minded village people, hardly equipped for the rigors of enquiry into the self that eluded even the most learned and disciplined of yogis. Parenthesis, there is good likelihood that he may have been speaking of himself at this point. End parenthesis. And I'll say more about the outcome of his years with Maharshi when I finish the story. The Muni could not understand why Maharshi would burden such people with the most advanced of all teachings and the hardest to practice and realize. Why had he not simply offered them practices within their reach, such as the repetition of mantras or simple ritual worship of the divine? Sometime later, the Muni also left, and then Ramana Maharshi returned from his walk. When apprised of Ganapati Muni's opinions, catching a typo, of his interaction with the villagers, Ramana had a response that, when I first read it, touched me deeply. And I should add here, as I'm reading along in this story, I'm thinking to myself, well, I mean, basically, Ganapati Muni is there as a disciple of his work. I mean, I wouldn't have been surprised if he got kind of miffed about it and had a few tart things to say. And by the way, although he's pictured as this purely benevolent, benign, peaceful sage, Ramana Maharshi had his angry moments. I know this because years ago, when I was with Adi Da, we published through the Dawn Horse Press a biography of Ramana Maharshi. I believe it was by a man named B.V. Those are initials, Narasimhaswamy. And Adi Da had me write the introduction to it as someone who had come to him through my exposure to Ramana and who was an editor serving his work. And he pointed out to me some information I'm not sure it's in that book, it may have come from somewhere else, that told the stories as kind of some of the underground material on Maharshi's life, told the story of how, especially in the kitchen, where he would go to help the disciples serving there, he would go to help them prepare the meals, and often many people would come for the afternoon and evening meals. And he was rather legendary for flying off the handle at people if they made some kind of mistake in the cooking or food preparation. So, all that is in my mind as I'm reading along in the story, and I read Ramana's response, which, as I just read here, it touched me deeply. He said something along these lines. What to do? This is what I know. And why give them all those complicated teachings and practices? If sooner or later they are going to have to give all that up anyway in order to dive into the heart and realize the self, why enjoin any unnecessary effort? In my book, The Conscious Principle, I point out that this orientation to his teaching made Ramana a daring experimenter among teachers of traditional Indian yoga. His learned disciple, Ganapati Muni, represented the orthodox traditional view that no one is capable of realizing the self and the heart until they have mastered all the preliminary physical, mental, moral, yogic, and spiritual disciplines and transformations. Maharshi himself had gone through no such preliminary disciplines before awakening in his youth. Though he often suggested he must have made great preparation in previous lifetimes, still, his orientation to our fundamental realization was crystallized in his teaching to these ordinary folk. It took them a long time to reach him, and they probably would never again have the time or opportunity to make another pilgrimage to his ashram. His heart full of compassion, he had to give them everything he could. Why waste time, he reasoned, on practices and methods that you're only going to have to abandon later in order to realize who you already are and, for that matter, always were. If it is at all possible, why not get at that realization directly? I also indicate in The Conscious Principle that in the early years of his own work, Adida frequently tried to help his students break through more gradual preliminary approaches. He initially gave a direct approach to what he called radical understanding, but found that no one was ready for it. He then began developing a whole framework of teachings that would, in effect, replace for people today and in the future the more traditional sequences of orthodox yogas taught in India, Tibet, and elsewhere. From time to time, however, in the first couple of decades of his work, Adida became impatient for his disciples' freedom. On those occasions, he interrupted the flow of his developmental teachings to say, what about the radical path of direct realization of consciousness? What about the path that cuts through and transcends an orderly progress through stages of evolutionary development of body, mind, and spiritual communion, and goes straight to the heart of awakening? He then encouraged and taught people ways to attempt to bypass the same kinds of preliminary disciplines that Ramana was trying to help people skip as well. So, just to come back here before I go too much further elsewhere. When Ganapati Muni died, a disciple asked Ramana if he had achieved self-realization. And Ramana said, no, how could he? He was too absorbed in all these other practices that still had his attention. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but that was something like what he did say. And, you know, to make a point here, there is still in this writing by me in Surefire and also in Waking Down a kind of a judgment that people should be able to cut through and outgrow those more preliminary practices that sooner or later are going to fall away anyway, whether it's, you see, through what Ramana called diving into the heart, or Adida called falling into the heart, or through what I started calling from the very earliest years, the rot. You know, more and more, you've heard me say this before, but it's probably worth saying with some frequency. I'm not inclined to view these incapacities as somehow resistance, reluctance, refusal, something people should be able to get over faster. I view them more as the developmental realities. Ganapati Muni wasn't ready to go into an actual realization of the heart through Ramana's teachings, if what Ramana said of him is accurate. And who knows, maybe some of those simple-minded village people were. We don't know. So for better or for worse, coming back to what I was reading here, only a very few of Adida's devotees ever successfully broke through into the capacity for radical transcendence he was enjoining. And in his later work, he has, I gather, almost entirely abandoned such interruptions. So I was writing this in 2000. He was still alive. I had left him in 1992. So I didn't really know. So the last few paragraphs of this essay say more about Adida and Ramana and then talk about my own orientation. Even so, as he refined his own view over the years, Adida always held that the liberating power of the heart, which he transmitted, might enable qualified candidates to bypass some or all of those higher adventures in soul development. Instead, they might pass from ordinary qualities of human maturity into the direct awakening of consciousness. True, he conceived the whole event in the context of devotion to him in person and as the only divine spirit consciousness of being. And he made it clear that the awakening of identification with and as that consciousness would entail an extensive process which he came to call the perfect practice, direct penetration of consciousness. These and other distinctive marks of his own approach and work aside, Adida clearly has taken forward the same fundamental impulse that Ramana Maharshi lived and voiced. Through the power of their transmissions, they both have made it possible in principle, if not altogether accessible in practice, for many others to take a shortcut from endless gradual evolution of the soul's experience and awareness. What they've made available instead is direct access to initiation and awakening of infinite consciousness. This is one of the most auspicious assets I have inherited from my two great heart gurus. In my own work, I've been overwhelmingly moved to help people cut through preliminaries and endless soulish adventures and get to the heart of the matter. As a result, I have no choice but to keep trying to find ways to help aspirants cut through the maze of hidebound ideologies and authoritative methods. And I suggest that my teachings on the rot and the core wound are a wondrously effective vaccine for the dis-ease that prompts our endless seeking and gradual but never conclusive attaining. My teachings on the rod and the core wound would allow everyday people who are hungry to fall directly into the heart and realize the self of limitless being. My teaching and transmission, and that of others, Linda Ma, and others now and others to come, to make this passage. So, I'm going to read a little more here. Actually, it's a chunk. It's another essay. But these essays, as you'll see, all of these essays from Surefire, I hope are then going to make the later passages, not only are they, I hope, illuminating the details of each chapter that I'm reading from Waking Down, but I hope they're also preparing us, preparing you particularly, to that much more fully appreciate the chapters that are coming in Waking Down. So this one starts on page 100. It goes over to page 103, and these are big pages in Surefire. On the nadis or nerve currents of soul-based seeking, the rot is an evolutionary expression of authentic passage beyond Sushumna and other nadis of life force, and into Atmanadi, the current of consciousness itself. You may recall, and you won't if you have not read this book, Surefire, but I'm reading here from what I wrote back in the day to those who presumably had read it. You may recall a lengthy quotation from Ramana Maharshi in Chapter 1, in which the great sage spoke of how the soul is said to descend into the body at birth from above through the fontanelle. This is the umbrella of nervous tissue that extends from the crown down into the core of the brain. It is also the same corona of nervous filaments that light up with living spirit in exalted yogic and mystical states. Many yogis, mystics, and saints have learned how to concentrate energy and attention in the higher nervous system and brain. There they are able to attune their soul receptivity to divine light. This is what produces phenomena like the form of nirvikalpa samadhi that is produced by the ascent of kundalini energy along the spine into the upper reaches of the brain and beyond. Now, in my case, when that first occurred in this lifetime, it actually started in the middle of the brain and went from there up infinitely. So I sensed, having completely lost all sense of any kind of perspective or a local self-presence in the ultimate nature of that samadhi state. Formless equalization of pressures is a translation of nirvikalpa samadhi. So thus, the individual soul nature appears to descend into embodiment and to ascend into states of divine illumination through the same nervous structures and, we may assume, closely related psycho-spiritual dynamics in the brain. Maharshi and Adida are in basic agreement that the living consciousness precedes and is the source of the soul's life energy and awareness, and that its seat is the heart, capital H. Specifically, they both have pointed to what medical science calls the sinoatrial node in the right atrium, or upper chamber of the physical heart organ, as the precise place of that seat. This smooth tissue with no outstanding physical features is the mysterious origin of the heartbeat. I've been given to understand, although I haven't seen conclusive evidence or scientific verification, that more recently some kind of physical tissue of that node, the sinoatrial node, has been found. But that's not really a decisive point. The smooth tissue with no outstanding physical features, and even also if it has some, is the mysterious origin of the heartbeat. It is here that life begins and is always sustaining itself in every moment. And it is here that the mystery of infinite conscious spirit most directly animates finite matter. It's not really that the consciousness is seated or located here more than it is anywhere else, or even that it can be said to be confined to any location whatsoever. Rather, as Adida has pointed out, it is here that the living conscious nature exists in most intimate apparent association with material and psychic human forms, life forms. There is then a physical anatomical basis for Ramana's and Adida's suggestions that seekers might bypass higher yogic and mystical evolutionary development and fall or dive directly into the heart. Ramana explained in those same passages I quoted above that the nadi or nerve current of consciousness, the Atmanadi, Atman is the self, so the nerve of the self, where the Amrita nadi, the nerve of immortality, Amrita, non-death, is a kind of extension, also translated as ambrosia and nectar, Amrita, is a kind of extension of the central spinal Sushumna nadi, the nerve current that the yogis travel in their ascent to mystical union. He described how Atmanadi or Amritanadi is not different from Sushumna, but extends it in a curve from the crown down into the roots of the self in the heart. In his work, however, he proposed that spiritual seekers need not become masters of the mystic path of raising energy and attention out of gross material inclinations and focusing it in forms of spiritual receptivity in the brain. Now, not all forms of yogic and mystical seeking focus on the brain. Many focus on the heart chakra, which is different from the sinoatrial node. The chakra is in the center. Sinoatrial node is on the right, and it's also psychoenergetically quite different. He urged people, Ramana did, to dive into the heart directly. What that meant anatomically is that he felt they need not master exercises designed to concentrate energy and attention in samadhi states in the upper regions of the brain. They need not even become modestly proficient. From his perspective, they need not even begin. Therefore, he was suggesting that it is quite unnecessary to complete the standard orthodox yogic or mystical journey of spiritual ascent to the crown of the head and beyond. No such preparation was necessary, in his view, for a person to be able to fall or dive into the heart through the nerve of the self. And that's heart with a capital H, with its principal ground of being seat in the right side rather than in the soul center of the chakra in the central part of the heart. With many distinctively different qualifications and a different goal for seekers, Adida expressed a nearly identical basic approach. As long as I was with him, certainly he was looking to help seekers bypass a potentially protracted yogic and mystical quest. He was convinced that they could, with the help of his transmission of the heart consciousness, fall into spontaneous readiness for self-realization of consciousness. And he too has suggested that this is possible without, in effect, going all the way up the Sushumna Nadi in order to negotiate the curve and start falling from high above. Why did Ramana and Adida come to this conclusion? Their own histories tell two very different stories. Ramana never did any yogic or mystical seeking in his entire life. His awakening came at the age of 17 in the midst of a crisis in which he felt himself dying. Earlier, he was to all appearances a rather ordinary youngster. He certainly had never activated yogic energies to produce ascended mystical states of union with the divine, nor was he ever moved to do so after awakening as the self in the heart, in other words, to try to achieve such states. Now, the fuller story here, in the couple of years before that great self-realization awakening, when he was 17, Ramana did develop a habit of going down to the local temple and standing before images of the gods and goddesses and perhaps some of the gurus of his region of India, and he would go into ecstatic devotional blisses with tears streaming down his face and so on. But that was not a mystical yogic path to try to ascend to anything. Anyway, yet, after his awakening, Ramana also experienced continuous light in the Atmanadi and the Sahasrar, the uppermost spiritual center in the brain. You must remember that Maharshi was a contemplative. All throughout his life, he spent many hours every day in silent communion. He wasn't trying to achieve anything internally. He just did, in general, as little as possible to stimulate movement of energy and attention downward and outward into life. That energy and attention thus conserved permitted the self-effulgence of consciousness to supercharge his whole body, nervous system, and brain. As a result, he experienced spontaneous activation of the higher centers in the brain continuously in and after his self-realization. Therefore, he felt that others also need not forcibly seek it in advance or afterward. Adida, again, in contrast, they're a very different story, did become an advanced Kundalini yogi before his own fall into the heart. He entered the highest ascended samadhi state of divine unity, Nirvikalpa Samadhi, in 1968, and then developed extensive experience as a yogic visionary over the following year. And there were already many, many, many mystical and yogic experiences in his life, even from childhood, before even learning about people who are such things as gurus. His guru, Swami Muktananda, openly acknowledged his proficiency and authorized him to teach Kundalini Yoga according to tradition. But then Adida found the whole orientation toward ascent, as well as any search for descent, dissolving in him. He went through a spontaneous shift in early 1970, in which he felt as if his Sahasrara, the upper crown chakra, were being cut off like a flower on a stalk in his brain. That remarkable yogic transition culminated in Adida's conclusive fall into the heart. In that event, he later reported the whole energy of his being shifted from the upward and downward ladder of living energy he had known as a yogi. It began to radiate in all directions to infinity from his heart. Though he continued to have extraordinary psychic and energetic experiences, his work thereafter became focused in the awakening of consciousness and spontaneous devotion to and union with the divine Shakti, the goddess, the divine feminine. Not as an abstraction, but in her very, very personal and attentive, mysterious presence in his life. His great transition into divine self-realization occurred some months later, in September of the same year. I myself experienced a variety of psychic, yogic, and mystical states before my fall into the heart in late 1992, as well as many intuitive apprehensions of the nature of consciousness. These included forms of Nirvikalpa Samadhi awakened through both intense spiritual ascent of Kundalini energy, the Kundalini energy, and temporary resolutions of attention back and down into the heart. My first ascended Nirvikalpa experience predated my exposure to either Ramana Maharshi or Adida. Another took place during my years in Adida's company, actually my early years. My first heart-based Nirvikalpa experience occurred the first time I read Ramana Maharshi's teaching in 1972 as an obvious effect of his grace. Two other instances of this samadhi took place during my years with Adida, directly as a result of his graceful transmission in turn. So, a couple of comments here. That first experience of the lightning-like, infinitesimal mystery of the self being in the heart, that took place when I first read some of Ramana's teachings, the very first day that I actually even seen a picture of him. This was in early May of 1972. It was something of a Nirvikalpa Samadhi experience in that for an instant my attention became so utterly wrapped in that sense of the beingness in the heart and its sudden activation, it's coming to life. I remember feeling as like it shot forward and up this infinitesimal space. But it wasn't, and I really, the only reason I call it Nirvikalpa is because in some of his own later writings, Adida made the point that it can have that quality or effect without there being an absolute and total cessation of all other subject-object qualities of experience and participation. So in that very instant, there was this rapt dissolution into that heart space, but without the complete dissolution of a kind of a flimsy attention to my surroundings and so forth. And it was all very instantaneous, so I never felt completely consumed by it. Should I even call it my first heart-based Nirvikalpa experience? Well, I'll call it so advisedly, based on comments from my former guru that I'm inclined to agree with, also for others' benefit. Because some people have had these intense kind of moments, But they feel, well, if all subject-object awareness doesn't completely and utterly become dissolved, is it full enough? Is it real? Am I still missing something? And I only say to them, you're only still missing something if it turns out you do wind up having it later. It's not going to prevent most people from fulfilling this process. So, to move on. Two other instances of this samadhi of the heart took place during my years with Adi Da, directly as a result of his graceful transmission in turn. Thus, I was privileged to enter these uncommon temporary apprehensions of infinite conscious spirit through the help of my two heart revealers. But once awakened, I inherited from both of them the orientation to streamline as fully as possible the dawning for others of direct self-realization. Ascended Nirvikalpa Samadhi and other higher spiritual experiences may turn out to be necessary for certain individuals, but is what is truly necessary in everyone's transition from soul-based willful seeking to the direct awakening of consciousness, or anatomically from the ups and downs of energy and attention in Susumna Nadi. And my brain is failing me, the other nadis that are not as central as Sushumna. Sorry about that. They exist, and they have their own names. Again, what is truly necessary in everyone's transition from soul-based willful seeking to the direct awakening of consciousness, or anatomically from the ups and downs of energy and attention in Sushumna Nadi to the fall into heart-centered radiant consciousness, is the rot. The correction I would make here is that most people never have done the work it would take, or don't have the pre-existing inclination to experience attention and energy as concentrated in Sushumna Nadi as a yogi or yogini who has done a decade or two or three or more of work to achieve that concentration and that inclination to ascent. So, hopefully that's clear. If you read Ramana's and Adi Da's biographies, you see evidence of this. Ramana's whole life was a marvelously uncomplicated rotting, better to say a lying fallow, until the precipitous events of his sudden self-realization. He didn't even have much of a religious life. Certainly he was no more of a worshipper than most of his contemporaries in South India at the end of the 19th century. I don't know. I don't know how many of his contemporaries could go into a temple and stand before images and have tears of devotion streaming out of their open heart of love. But in any case, Ramana was not someone who cultivated these disciplines we're talking about. Adi Da went through months of spiritual listlessness after his ascent into divine Nirvikalpa Samadhi in the late 1960s. His own autobiography yields clear evidence that his whole being required a massive reconfiguration from the entire dynamics of soul-based yogic descent and ascent. This then culminated in the, quote, severing of the Sahasrara, unquote, in early 1970, which in turn paved the way for his conclusive divine self-realization later that year. The rot doesn't cleanse the soul of material dross. That's the work of the dark night of the soul, a different possible passage. The rot cleanses the whole being of soul and mind-based adventuring in the flux of changing phenomena made of energy, life force, or light. It prepares the whole being to begin living from the basis of awakening and then awakened consciousness. And it allows us to make the esoteric anatomical turn, so to speak, from Sushumna Nadi to Atma Nadi. Once called it frequently in earlier time in my work, I called it the Shepherd's Cross. The Sushumna Nadi is this straight staff going from the body base up to the crown of the head, maybe even beyond, and the Atma Nadi curls down from there into the heart, especially that being consciousness center on the right. It permits us to pass beyond immersion in the flux of phenomena that we cannot help but experience when energy and attention are situated in Sushumna Nadi, analogous to the central nervous system, and its autonomic correlate nadis known as Ida and Pingala. If only I had read this in advance, I would not have betrayed to you my own unawareness of my own essay. But there you have it. Unlike Adida, I never developed yogic concentration in Sushumna Nadi. Most human beings don't and can't. Those who do astonish us with their preternatural communion with divine spirit, love, and light. They become our rare great saints, mystics, yogis, and devotees. Unlike Ramana, I was not equipped for direct passage out of ordinary life into Atmanadi. Most human beings aren't and don't. Those who do amaze us with their fierce abandonment of ordinary conventions of individual identity. They become our rare great sages. Unlike the giants on whose shoulders I stand, and all my spiritual experiences and samadhis notwithstanding, I never succeeded in any form of spiritual seeking. But my last 5 years and more in Adida's company was a massive, unrelenting rot. 5 years, 1992, so that would be 1987, well, 1988 through early, late 88 through early 1990, I was invited to be with him and his entourage on the island in Fiji that was his primary sanctuary. I wouldn't say that my entire time there was massive, unrelenting rot, but most of those last 5 years and more really were. That was when I lost hope and began resigning myself to an unawakened existence. That was when I began concluding that I had no capacity even to seek to become a good devotee any longer, especially in the later portion of that 5 years. Somehow I made the turn and fell into the heart. If I was able to do it, so can you. I think this is what being, capital B, wants, so to speak. I don't think there are many who are capable, even with great helping grace, of the Olympic spiritual feats of a Ramana, or an Adida, or a Bhagavan Nityananda, or Swami Muktananda, or of a St. Francis of Assisi, or a St. Seraphim of Sarov, or of the Baal Shem Tov, the great founder of medieval Hasidism, one of its great founders, or of any number of great yogis, saints, mystics, sages, etc., etc. I think there are many, however, who can duplicate the failures, or at best the sporadic grace-given achievements, and then the rotting and dropping of a sanya. Beyond them, I think there are even more who can receive this argument about our ultimate evolution and transcendence and use it to their best advantage. They can hear this revelation about the rot at the core of their being and allow it to retire them from anxious, fruitless, endless seeking. I think there are many, many, many human beings now and in the future who can recognize the futility of hypermasculine striving and seeking before they make a serious habit of it. They can then permit the rot to drop them out of chronic enthrallment to what, in an earlier essay here, I called the perpetual cosmic out-of-court payoff machine. That quality of universal existence that keeps giving us bits and pieces of what we want, keeping us hooked to the carrot of what we want more of, long before they might otherwise fall out of that chronic enthrallment. This is my hope. So, you know, it may well be that first birth realizers are those who are really, really enjoying, even continuously, great communion, great union, great abidance in and as the self. Very, very hard for such people to be truly and effectively attracted into the rot. But for most of us, maybe we're blessed to be that much more exposed to the ordinary pains and elusive pleasures of living and can permit this passage. And both true listening, both effective listening and effective reception of transmission, especially in mutual listening and being heard and mutual transmission and reception, with a competent master of this process or adept, teacher of it, not merely teacher of words, that those kinds of attention can facilitate and expedite this passage. And that is why I heartily recommend them, and that is why with session 18 we go into transmission and the adept's job, chapter 9 of Waking Down. Blessings on your journey. Thank you for listening. I look forward to you hearing from me again soon. It's a one-way communication in many ways, but I hope it's doing your heart and soul and body and mind a lot of good. Much love.